it's my pleasure to welcome Lorna Farrell to the Sonship podcast. Lorna has been a friend for a long time and a busy woman, so we don't see each other that often. Lorna, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be here, John. Thanks for asking me. I'm kind of looking forward to it, I think.
I'm looking forward to it. I'll be gentle.
Good.
Now, people might not know you, Lorna, but you've been a chaplain to a women's football team. You're a writer. You've been a sports broadcaster, interviewing people like Beckham and Samuel L. Jackson and people like that. You currently manage a recording artist, and one of the songs you wrote with him has hit the Billboard Top 10. You know, and did I say you've done stand-up? You've written a couple of books. You're involved in activism regarding human trafficking and the mesh implant scandal in Scotland. I'm exhausted now. How do you manage all that?
I was going to say, what you didn't say was I also managed to sleep in for today's allotted time. That's why.
Well, no wonder all of that on your books.
To be fair, I'm not doing it all in the same day. Do you know, I think I just feel really blessed that sometimes I get annoyed with myself and think, like, what am I actually doing? You know, because I've never been a sort of 9-to-5 person and not had good structure. So my organizational skills are woeful. But I feel really
I can testify to that.
I just feel like I've just been really blessed that kind of doors have opened at different times in my life. So I've been able to pursue things that I'm passionate about. And it's great because I enjoy doing all of these things. The downside of that is, you know, it's not necessarily a sort of stable, do you know what I mean? Like, so I feel like I lurch from one thing to another, but I love everything that I do. So that's the main thing.
Because in the midst of that, you brought up two boys. So I mean, like,
I did.
You were fitting all of this stuff in and having little kids running around, and my goodness.
I think.
Are you Superwoman in disguise?
No, you know me, far from it. I think the bringing up the boys was possibly the hardest part, but the best part. And I mean, they're all grown up now and they live away, and now my granny as well. And that's so much fun. Being a granny is to, you just get fun with them. Not all the responsibility of when.
And then hand them back.
Exactly, exactly. And somehow I've forgotten how to change a dirty nappy, it seems. So, whoops, there you go, son. but yeah, I think I didn't have my faith when I was first married, and then when my marriage ended, and so there I was, a single mum, and I was terrified, and it is very, very difficult. And I mean, they still saw their dad at weekends. So I wasn't completely on my own, but yeah, it was tough going. And then sort of trying to, then I discovered a Christian faith, and I was trying to walk with God, and he was very gracious, because I definitely had one foot in church, one foot in the world. You know what I mean? I was like, yeah, there at church every Sunday. And right early on, I realized that I loved kind of like ministry, and I'm probably an evangelist at heart. So I love speaking to people that don't come to church. So I loved prison ministry. But I think the rest of the team were maybe tearing their hair out, because I would have been out on a Saturday night and have a hangover and be talking to guys who I never even thought about it were in rehab in prison, and I'm sitting, you know, with my hangover, stinking of drink and everything. But God is so gracious. It was slowly, he was really gentle with me, and not like, don't ever go out and do anything. But yeah, so it's been a lot of grace of God, great family and friends, and just being a chancer, really. That's that's what's happened there.
Pretty much sounds a good way to do life. Or not.
I think I've got that. Yeah, I'll give that a go. Put my hand up in class before I knew what it was. I think I still have that. I've carried that on into my adult life.
So is that how you ended up in sports broadcasting? You just stuck your hand up for something and didn't know what it was?
Well, that was, I think that comes under the being a chancer category. When I was sort of supposed to be doing my hires and things like that, I was already going out and discovered drink and good music and boys, and so I didn't get enough qualifications to get into university, and I sort of wasted that part of my life. So when I became a Christian and I'm this single mum, and obviously that impacted me financially as well. So I needed to go get a job, but I'd started to read the word, which said, ask and you'll be given, knock and the door will open. So because I was just a baby Christian, I was just like, okay, God, and thought it was some kind of benevolent Santa Claus or something. And so I was like, can I get a job in sports broadcasting, please? So I went to a radio studio. I did a couple of interviews, actually. A couple of Old Firm footballers stayed near me. And so I recorded a couple of interviews with them just so I could show somebody that I did, you know, although I didn't have qualifications, I've always loved writing. I've always loved sports. So I knew that I could do the job. It was just trying to get somebody to believe in me. Yeah. So eventually what I did was I took these interviews to, and I carried them to every football match I went to. And it was this guy, I didn't know his position, but I knew he was at radio because he had a mic. So I just said, excuse me, I would really like your job. Could I follow you for a week and do your job at the radio station? Maybe you could ask your boss. And he said, oh, do you want my job? Do yes or no? He said, well, I'm head of sports, so I don't think I'm going to give you my job. I quite like it. And I said, okay, well, why don't you let me work for a week for nothing? And if I'm any good, you know, you can give me a job. If I'm not, nobody's lost anything. So he said, okay. And so for a week, I just, you know, did it for nothing. And then I got a job at the end of it. And I started off on breakfast show doing like travel reports and then football reports at the weekend, and then gradually moved up. And I actually, and it totally a lot of favor from God, I have to say, and hard work, but it doesn't feel like hard work when you're doing something you love. I mean, how can it be hard work if I'm at Wimbledon interviewing Martina Navratilova, one of my absolute heroes of the sport? Like, that's not work.
Fiona always says that about her job in education. Like, she said, I don't know how much I make. I just get paid for doing what I like.
Exactly. What is it? If you do what you love, you'll never work in your life or something like that. I'm sure there's a good cliche in there somewhere.
So you interviewed Martina?
I did. At Wimbledon. I loved her. And who else did I? I got friendly with somebody who became a bit of a hero, was Colin McRae. And I'd, because of my age, which is ancient now, 942, I remember the McRae, you know, I remember Colin's dad, Jimmy McRae, just, you always used, you know, you used to see like the British rally on the telly and this, like, so I would interview, I'd do a little slot every week with Colin on my radio program, just, it wasn't live, but so he invited me to be a guest of Ford in Corsica, and that began a friendship with Colin. So that was amazing, because I got to interview David Coulthard a few times as well, but mostly in Scotland. In fact, one of my favorite interviews was with a German athlete called Heike Drechsler, and she she did multiple sports, and it was such an interesting interview because they had actually been drugged for all of her career, it came out, but she didn't know anything about it. They were all the sort of elite East German and West German.
Was she a heptathlete?
I think she was. I know she was a high jumper and she was a runner. I'm not sure if it was actually in the heptathlon or if it was separate disciplines. Yeah. And of course, that was in the days before the Berlin Wall was down and everything, before the unification of Germany. So it was just so interesting because she had just been taken as a child to this elite sports training, and, you know, they never questioned, and she had undoubtable natural ability.
Yeah.
They'd been given some. So that was huge. But it was also my favorite interview because my dad loved her. And so being able to do this sort of fangirl thing and get an autograph from my dad, that was great. But the majority of interviews I did were around football, because that in Scotland, when you say sports journalist, it can translate to football journalist. Yeah,
That's how people interpret it.
Yeah. But I worked for a smaller, it was the biggest commercial station, but so it wasn't the BBC. So I actually had freedom to go and, you know, go to Wimbledon and cover golf and cover squash and things like that, sports that, because let's face it, if you were going to, you know, if you're a massive football fan, you would listen to either the BBC or another radio station. We weren't known for our sport. So I had the privilege of trying to build the sport up. And so I got to cover. I thought, well, why don't we start to offer, you know, so, even an update on the Speedway or an update on rugby league? Who knew? You know, Scotland posted.
So did that mean you ended up head of sports broadcasting?
It did, yes. So I got that guy's
Fantastic.
job. It took a few years, but yes.
But out of that, you wrote a book, didn't you, about sport and faith?
I did, because different people. I did. At that time, I kept meeting Christian footballers or reading about them or hearing about them. And by this time, I think my boys were in their teens and not interested in church, and I knew they'd never read a Bible.
Yeah.
And I thought, but they love football, and there must be lots of teenagers like that who are not at all interested in coming to church or don't know what the Bible's about, but would read something about football. And it also fascinated me what difference somebody's faith makes to their sport, which is, you know, hugely competitive. And especially if you're playing in a team sport, you have to be out for your team, but that means you have to be against the other team, and just, you know, just little nuances like that. So I wrote this book called God's Never Offside. See what I did there? See what I did there, John? I interviewed, I think, 11 Christian footballers and a referee. So, and I just gave them
a full team.
A full team, yes. And yeah, I just gave them each a different subject, like, you know, why they read the Bible, and, you know, is the devil real, and what they thought about, you know, not having sex outside of marriage. The guys were great. They were just really honest and up for it. Wow. And so, yeah, that was.
I know you're not supposed to have a favorite, but did you have a favorite out of those interviews?
I loved each and every person the same. It's hard because two of the people are my friends, so I have to say them. So Marvin Andrews,
they're your friends, so they'll forgive you if you don't say them.
Yeah, Marvin Andrews and Graham Matthey, their chapters were awful. No,
Marvin's an interesting character.
He's a very interesting character, and Marvin's a very bold character, which I love. I don't always agree 100% with it, you know, with everything Marvin believes, but I love his passion, and I love he's just everything's out there with Marv. So he was a great place to start. Who else? I think it was Graham. I gave the most, not necessarily difficult, but possibly the most awkward chapter in No Sex Before Marriage, and he was just a young single guy at the time, and he actually had some good stories. I did enjoy that chapter, because you can imagine in, you know, professional football, and he's come up through the ranks of what the dressing room chat's like, and he was like really honest saying, I have to even decide, you know, not to look at page 3 when the guys are, not to, because anything that's going to lead me and make it more difficult for, you know, to remain a virgin, which is what he wanted before he got married. So he was really honest, and so that's a good chapter.
I mean, that must have been quite difficult as well, that job, because you're a woman, which is in a job, head of sports broadcasting, in a typically male environment. I mean, traditionally that's been a man's thing.
Yeah.
Commentating and all that.
I think it's less so now. It's great to see there's way more females presenting, interviewing, producing, directing, editing, and of course...
And winning World Cups.
Exactly. The best thing I was going to say is that women's sport has been given the platform it deserves. I mean, it's great to see what's happening now. And I actually love that when I was in sport, there was a lovely lady called, and this is terrible because now I've forgotten, but her name was Betty, and I forget her surname, and she was in at the SFA, and she was like a lone voice championing women's football. And this has gone back 20 years, 25 years, and 30 years. She'd been there before. For me, and she was just, you know, like women's football, and it was, nobody was interested. And I think in my job, I probably came in when females were starting to, you know, there was I love people like Hazel Irvin.
Yeah.
You know, she was a sort of trailblazer.
She's the first one I remember.
I remember Sally McNair, I think, was the first. I loved Sally as well.
She was the first female
I ever saw reading sports news and was like, wow, I want to do that. And now, of course, it's just great to see. Yeah. But at the time, it was male dominated. But I never ever had any issues with any of my fellow journalists. That was never an issue. Sometimes, you know, maybe some sexist comments or things from some people, but it actually used to be more like, you know, like if you were talking to a taxi driver or something.
Yeah.
What do you do? Oh, I'm a sports journalist. Oh, where's that? Uh-huh. And what's your role there? Well, actually, I'm head of sport. You're head of sport. You'd be like, yeah. You know, so, but there wasn't, I didn't ever encounter any issues within. A couple of comments. Yeah. Somebody who shall remain nameless said to me one day, oh, I can't talk to you just now, dear. I've got to go and do the press. I was like, I am the press. You know, like.
I could throw out a couple of names. Maybe, but nope. So how did faith work in amongst all of that in that environment?
Well, this was all early on, I would say, when I was still kind of half in, half out, and not half in my beliefs, but only half in kind of walking the walk, as they say. So yeah. I would, I told everybody I was a Christian. I would talk about Jesus all the time. And sometimes I think Jesus must have been like, Lorna, please. I know what you're going to say next, so please stop telling everybody. So I would be doing that and very vocal and open, and everybody I worked with knew I was a Christian and I went to church on a Sunday. But equally, I did a two-hour live show on a Friday. And so Friday afternoon, I was hugely crabby. I was hugely stressed. I usually, you know, I would swear if something went wrong. Do you know what I mean? Like, I wasn't exactly the best witness. I was still kind of half and half, and so
but you're real better than being pretending.
Well, yes, I was real, but like I say, I think sometimes God must have been like, okay, you probably don't need to tell them all about me while you're drunk, Lorna. I'm saying that as if I was always drunk. I wasn't. It was just that was the period,
just mostly.
Oh my, no. There is actually a funny story. I went to every Thursdays and Fridays were when you went and interviewed all the managers ahead of the weekend's football games. And I very rarely went out because the radio station was like 30 miles from where I lived. So, you know, I left the house at 4 every morning. And however, I'd been persuaded to go to this midweek thing. And so I went to it and I was drinking, and I actually ended up sleeping in the studio, and that was fine. Anyway, I'm out interviewing this manager, who thankfully I knew very well, and radio's always last. It always works out that they do the daily papers first, then the Sundays, then they do television, then they do radio. So I've been waiting for a good hour and a half in a nice warm media room. So by the time he came to me, I fell asleep. So all I remember is this manager going, Lorna, Lorna. And I'm like, And he's like, you're the last one here. Do you still want to do an interview? And I was like, oh my goodness. And I was so like, sorry. And he said, do you want me to start? And he ended up sitting, this Scottish Premier League manager sitting going, right, you'll probably ask me, what's my team for tomorrow? Well, my team's going to be, and he just interviewed himself while I lay there, like, not my finest hour. But I have to say, I don't drink anymore, and I'm way more professional in everything I do, John. True.
Are you sure about that?
Maybe not professional, but I definitely don't drink anymore.
Yeah, but you still fall asleep before interviews.
Well, is this the part where you tell everybody that I slept in for today as well? maybe I can't.
But when you think about it, I mean, having that career, for most people, that would be their life. That, you know, like, that's enough of a career. But then you've been a chaplain to a ladies' football team.
I think sometimes
carrying on that sports theme.
Yes, and I love that. I've actually just given that up this year, and I miss it. It's still that was a passion, but the giving up of the sports career, I don't actually think I was supposed to. I think I kind of jumped the gun there. I you know that way when you don't really have peace about something, but I think my head thought it was a good idea. And so I was sure God would too, because what I went on to do was a, you know, was a Christian thing. So I'm like so sure that's what God would want me to do. But you know, on reflection, I don't think it was. I got it into my head. You know, I was walking closer with God. I wasn't drinking, wasn't smoking anymore. You're trying to be more professional, trying to be more. And I got it into my head that God would probably want me to work in a Christian radio company, radio station, which is a lovely, you know, that's a good thing, Christian radio, but I don't actually think it's what God was calling me to do. I also went to make some television programs. So in my head, I had it all sorted. By the end of a couple of months, I would be the next Oprah Winfrey. I'd have a primetime television show, and be doing Christian radio as well. So
And
that never
God
quite
laughed.
worked out. Yeah, God laughed and said, I think he actually said no, Lorna, but I didn't listen. So
I think you interviewed me for that radio station, actually.
I think I did. I think more than once, actually. So yeah, and I mean that was great fun and very much my wheelhouse, I would say, is interviewing people. This is what I love about God, because years before, just sort of on the cusp of my marriage ending, I did a 2-year counseling course. And, you know, I wasn't a Christian at that point. You know, I was married. And so I did this. And, you know, it was a lot and it was long and, you know, it was a very big commitment. But just sort of towards the end of it, just when I qualified, my marriage ended. And my lecturer actually asked me to go and work in a counseling center with her. You know, she thought I was ready for it. My first client was somebody with marriage problems. It was just a nightmare, and it was clear that I couldn't do it. I wasn't in a fit place to be a counselor. So I always wondered, what was that all about? Was that just a waste of time? That was 2 years of my life, and I'm never going to be a counselor, sort of thing. But you know, I would say my biggest passion is storytelling. And the biggest skill I had, because it certainly wasn't, you know, my timekeeping, organization, or editing skills, was
No comment.
actually is actually interviewing people, is talking to people, getting people's stories out, telling stories. And all of those skills I learned on that counseling course, not to ask closed questions, nonverbal signals. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I just think God wastes nothing. That was not a waste of 2 years of my time, aside from having a good skill set to be able to listen to people. It actually taught me how to interview people. So yeah, so that was a little
So
sidebar, John. A sidebar.
was that beneficial when you started doing stand-up comedy?
The only thing that was beneficial was I was able to counsel myself after I felt crushed after dying on stage a couple of times. Stand
But
up.
then every comedian has that
Yeah.
happen to them, don't they? That's
They do. And if they
even Kevin,
don't,
even guys like Kevin Bridges and
even
Mickey
Kevin
Flanagan and
Bridges.
all those guys, they've all
Yeah.
said
Yeah. If they
I've
don't,
owned.
they're kidding. I think the thing that helped me one time I bombed on stage at the Edinburgh Festival, and I was doing two performances, and I did exactly the same material 2 hours later to a different audience, and it's the best gig I've ever done with the best reception I've ever had. So the audience makes a big difference, do you know what I mean? And I didn't change any of the material. It's just there's something. Sometimes it's not just about the comedian, you know, saying. Sometimes the audience are nervous or stoic, or somebody laughs too much actually, and then people stop. There's all sorts of crazy. If you're in a bad mood because you've not had your drink served in time when you've come in, if there's a big queue to the toilet, all of these things actually affect
And the comedian
people's
picks on you
enjoyment.
then.
Yes, I never did
Did you
that.
not? You never picked on people in the
I
front
did
row?
never picked on Indy because I hate that. I do always wonder why do people sit up the front of like a Billy Connolly or Frankie Boyle, or I mean
Because
you're just gonna get.
secretly they want to be picked on.
Oh no, no,
Wait,
no, no.
how did that work faith-wise? I mean, I've as you know, I've put on comedy nights in the past with like Andy and Tony Vino, and I always keep thinking it was Nish Kumar, but it wasn't Nish that came up to Glasgow that time.
Oh, who was it?
Who was that?
He was very funny.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I can't remember.
It looked like Nish, and he was a small guy, but I don't think it was Nish.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was. But, it was very funny. But
so where does faith interact with all that? How close can you get to
when I first
your faith kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, when I first started, I did character comedy. So I created this character. She was an X Factor contestant, and she was a sort of, she was a very sort of, her name was Beyoncé McGumphrey, and she was, you know, like a very Glaswegian, very excitable, not able to sing. So it was a character. So that's kind of, and it was also a little bit different because there's not much character-driven comedy on the circuit. And I didn't do like Christian comedy or clean comedy. I just did
just comedy.
I just did comedy, but personally I try not to swear, and my comedy is clean. So for me it was more going around the pubs and clubs in Glasgow and Edinburgh. It was more getting to know the other comedians, and then I was able to share that I was a Christian. And that's where the sort of, it's not something, at first it wasn't something that came out on stage because I was doing character stuff. I then started to do straight sort of stand-up. The first joke, of course, being as I came on in a wheelchair, you know, I'm sure you want your money back because you paid for stand-up. I would bring in the fact that I was a Christian, came in. And usually, you know, I'd be sort of slagging myself. And so it wasn't like a big contentious, it was just, I'm a Christian. This is the core of who I am. So I would share that and put that out there, but it wasn't, you know, I there would probably be an aside about, you know, y'all hate me now, or there's the only 10 I've left after I've said that or something. It was just an aside, but it was important to me. Again, it's back to, I think I'm an evangelist at heart. It's important to me that I say that I'm a Christian, because it's the most important thing to me. So,
cool.
But I was never that funny. And I struggled. I was funnier in my head and funnier in rehearsals. And I think I think genuinely I struggle with anxiety. And so it's not a place to be. You're so vulnerable and you're standing there, and it's that, those seconds. And even, you know, good friends that I met along the way, even like I went to a very, very early Kevin Bridges gig. He was like way down the support, you know, he was like opening for somebody, and he was just about 17. And I remember talking to him, and it just came back to me on my very first gig. It's the second before you start speaking when you just realize that there's a room full of people and you have to make them laugh. And there's no, it's not like you have music or there's
no pressure
nothing.
Then, huh?
It's just this spotlight. So I never, the problem with me was my anxiety would kick in when I was on stage, and that affected my delivery. And yes. I had a wonderful professional comedian called Stu, who's very experienced.
Oh, yeah.
Very experienced, say to me, your act is brilliant, but you're not, you need to learn to, they call it riding the laugh. So if the audience are laughing, you never speak. You let the laugh come like a wave. But I never did. As soon as somebody started laughing, I was like, oh good, right on the next break. And you know, and in my head I would always see the person that looked at their watch or didn't laugh at something. He hates it, they all hate it, that, you know, and so I would be hurrying myself up. And so it wasn't the greatest experience. Sometimes I think, would I go back and do that? Because I do enjoy, I'm still part of a Christian comedians group, and we meet up before pandemic once a year, have a retreat, everybody writes some stuff, and I always have to be persuaded to go on and perform on the last night. We just perform because, and it's such a safe environment, everybody's encouraging, you know, the critique is always positive. So for a few years, I didn't perform at all because I thought, right, I've got it. I can't perform. I can write some funny stuff, but I can't perform. So that's fine. But they persuaded me to. And when it was on, I actually really enjoyed it. And I was more, you know, I was getting more into it, more animated and more like, well, I like that laugh. And so I don't know. I don't think I've completely shut the door on stand-up comedy. But yeah, I think what I actually want to do is a one-woman show. And then I think, who would want to know my story? But I think I'd love to do a 1 hour show that incorporates some comedy, you know, has some funny bits, but has some just the journey I've been through. If it could encourage anybody else, I think I would like to do that. So watch this space for Edinburgh next year. That's my target.
Speaking about writing, you've written some songs as well, haven't you?
I have, yes. That's hysterical. God definitely has a sense of humour. Because
you manage a young man.
I do.
The Christian world.
Yes, his name is Jamie Kimmett and he's from Ayrshire, obviously God's own country, as you well know. And he kind of, I haven't managed him his whole career, and it's just a sort of, probably just a sort of temporary thing, I would say. Jamie was out in Nashville, and he had a really bad car crash, and he couldn't play guitar or anything, so he sort of had a year out. But he's my best friend. He used to live with the boys and I. We write songs together, so it's just kind of day-to-day management just now, and we'll see what the future holds up. But obviously I've got my stuff to do, he's got his stuff to do. But we wrote a song together that came out of some struggles he's had and some struggles I'd had, because I became disabled about 8 years ago. And so we wrote this song called Prize Worth Fighting For. And one of the lines in it is, when every day is just another struggle and every choice is an act of war, you've got to pray, got to press on to the prize worth fighting for. And I think that that's a sort of culmination of both of our stories. And when things have gone wrong and you're just like, God, where are you? Or do you know what I mean? So as I say, God has a great sense of humor, because I'm completely tone deaf. Jamie has the voice of an angel. And it's incredibly musical.
I've seen Jamie play. He's very good.
Yeah, and it's musicality.
What was the outcome with that song then?
Well, let me see. It went to number 9 on the Billboard charts in America.
Number 9 in America.
How funny is that?
Billboard. Nice.
Yeah. In the gospel chart. So yeah. So awesome. Christian music chart. So that was good. So I'm managing him just now, and we just did a summer tour in America. We did a sort of backyard tour, so he was playing a couple of festivals anyway. One was at Johnny Cash's farm.
Hate you.
got to go to Johnny Cash's farm. That was really cool.
Saying it again doesn't make me hate you any less, Lorna.
Did I tell you I got to go to Johnny Cash's farm? And so he played some cool places. We were in Memphis, New Orleans,
nice.
Florida, New York. I mean, it was great.
Nice.
So he was doing some festivals, and then we got some backyard tours as well. And so we've written some new songs. So there'll be new music out next year.
Wow.
It's amazing. It's what I said at the top of the thing. God just seems to have given me opportunity to do things that I love. You know, I don't think I'm going to be a songwriter for forever, but every now and again, I love writing songs. So yeah, and I think the thing is, I just believe in Jamie. It's not like I want to be a music manager. That was never on the horizon for me. But I love
his
voice. Yeah, and it's came out of just being a pal and encouraging him and going, oh well, why don't I make that phone? Also, again, being a chancer helps. I'm used to phoning up people or passionate, something I'm passionate about, or you mentioned I was an activist. So I like to knock on doors and say, excuse me, give this a listen, or try, you know, so.
Yeah. And having I used to do that when I was managing the band.
That's right. You used to do that.
I organized the recordings. I organized merchandise. I booked gigs. I organised transport. I drove the transport to the gigs and the conferences and the all
that. It's so much more, isn't it, than just turning up on the day. And
I think I wrote 3 of the first songs on the first recording. You know, so, but like you say, it wasn't because that's what I wanted to do. It's just like I thought these guys are good. I can help them.
Yeah. Would you go back to that? Do you think you would like to?
I don't know. I think I'm like you, Laura. It's just, well, there's a door open. I'll stick my head around and see what's there.
Yeah, you know? I think both you and I were absent when the careers officer, careers guidance person was there at school. It's like, what is your career plan? I don't know. We'll just keep walking through doors and enjoying ourselves.
They had guidance at school?
I think so.
No one told me. But now you said in the midst of that that you became disabled 8 years ago. What happened there?
Well, it was 2008. I had to have what was allegedly a simple procedure, a women's problem. And so this was supposed to be like a 20-minute operation. I was going to have a mesh implant and that was fine. So in 2008, to be fair, it kind of worked, but I had a bit of pain, but it wasn't too bad. And so for the first couple of years, it was just okay. However, it got sorer and sorer and more debilitating. So I had lots of run-ins and fights with the surgeon who implanted it, telling me it was all in my head, there was nothing wrong, and it would be this, that, or the next thing. And so I had two or three other exploratory operations and procedures, but never coming back to this mesh. However, in 2013, I read about this woman who had had the exact same operation, who was in terrible pain. And this led me to become part of Scottish Mesh Survivors, a group that was campaigning to get it recognised that mesh causes damage. Then in 2014, I had to go for, I think, about my fourth operation at this point, and they were going to remove a little bit of it. So as soon as I woke up from the operation, I knew something was badly wrong. And during the operation, they cut through my obturator nerve because the mesh attaches itself inside, and it was attached to organs and muscles and everything inside. So it caused huge internal damage and also cut through my obturator nerve. So it left me with permanent nerve damage and with horrific pain, which I still have 24/7. And I couldn't walk. So I ended up in a wheelchair. And it was funny because if somebody had said to me that I would end up using a wheelchair, I would have said, well, no, God wouldn't let that happen because, you know, you knew me, John. I mean, I used to do cartwheels just when people were talking to me, and I never stood still, and I played badminton. I walked 5 miles a day. I went hill climbing. You know, I was a hugely active person. So I was so sure God wouldn't let anything like that happen to me. So it was a massive, how did this happen? And I ended up using a wheelchair. So it's been a long battle and lots of long dark nights of the soul. But 3 years ago, friends and family crowdfunded, and I went out to America and had an operation to get it all removed. And that means I can walk now. I still have a walker because I fall quite a lot, because the nerve damage means that, like, it's usually my right side gives way a lot and I fall. And I also still have chronic pain, but I'm more mobile, if that makes sense. So before I just used a wheelchair, now I can actually stand up straight, I can walk, but it's just everything I do is in pain. So I can't sit for too long or I'll be in agony and I seize up. I can't stand for, but I go about my life as best I can. I have lots of days where I'm in bed. So it's been quite a journey. Not one I would have planned, but
I mean, you must have had some dark days in that.
Oof, I still do. But I did. At the beginning, I had the why me, God? Like, why? Yeah. Why would you let this happen? And why me? And then it was so funny because a turning point for me actually came one time when I felt as if God said to me, why not? And I was like, what? And I felt like God said, why not? You know, this is happening to thousands of women around the world. Why would I not let it happen to you too? And do you truly believe that in all things I'm working for the good? And I've said that verse so many times in my life, Romans 8:28, and said it to other people too, and felt like, yeah, I do believe it. I do believe that God is working for good in this. And that gave me a mind shift of, well, what could he be doing with it? And I've always hated injustice. I'm somebody that's went on marches and protests all my life. You know, I was the daughter of a miner. you know, I well remember the miners' strike, and I've just grown up in a working class family believing it's important to speak up for what you believe, to stand up for what you believe. You know, I'm passionate about civil rights. I don't know how many marches I went on to free Mandela and stuff like that. So I believe that God made my personality this way. Do you know what I mean? Like, to hate injustice. And so being able, and also, again, God not wasting anything, having a media background, I was able to, you know, do radio and television interviews about the Mesh. I joined worldwide groups as well as Scottish groups and UK groups, and met a lot of Christian women that this had happened to too. And so we're able to be praying for all these women that we meet. And it has turned out to be a privilege and a blessing. Mm-hmm. And also the biggest impact for me has been in my faith. Has been in how much I trust God, which sounds bizarre because you would think, well, maybe I wouldn't trust. I know somebody in an interview said that to me, well, surely you don't trust God now. And it's like, no, actually, I trust him more, because I was always, and part of that, I think, was probably being a single mum, but I've always had to be independent and do things for myself. So, and also, you know, being a female in a male-dominated world, you know, you're always having to sort of do things yourself, or trying to prove. Yeah, it's almost like you had to just go a little bit further just to be the same. So yeah, I was used to that. So I think often I would say, yes, I, you know, I've given everything to God, and I hadn't, and I would do it myself, and I would, you know, be like, okay, God, you know, I'm off to do this, if you could just bless it. Or so when you find yourself in a place where you can't control it, I couldn't, you know, I couldn't make myself walk, I can't take the pain away, I have to trust God. And I have great friends around me, but nobody can be there 24/7. You know, my kids are grown up and gone now. So I'm living on my own, awake at 3, 4, 5 in the morning in agony. Or for a few years, I was on really powerful medication, which I got addicted to. So I then had to battle an addiction as well and get off of all my medication. So there'd been lots of long, dark nights of the soul. And it's then you realize that the one constant is God, and he's there. And just in the middle of your tears, hearing, I'm never going to leave you or forsake you. You can trust me. I've got you. And it's almost like I feel like I fell into his arms and didn't wrestle it out of them this time, because I've done that before. I know God's got me, but this time I couldn't physically run anyway. There was nowhere to run to, do you know what I mean? So, yeah, so genuinely, and I'm not just saying this because you're a Christian too, but genuinely, if somebody said to me, you could get rid of all the pain and, you know, get your full health back and be running about doing cartwheels, but you would lose the closeness that you now have with God, I wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't, because this closeness with God, don't get me wrong, I'm still a little brat, and I'm not 24/7, you know,
I remember you saying to me when we met, maybe a year or so after you were in the wheelchair, saying, like, you know what, this is the closest I've ever been to God.
I
remember you saying that to me.
And it's true.
It had an impact on me. Because I thought, my goodness, would I have that? Would I feel that way if it was me?
I remember reading somebody asked Charles Spurgeon he adored his wife, Susanna, and somebody said, are you saying that, you know, you've got the strength to, you know, trust God even if Susanna, you know, were to die a horrible death or something like that? And he said, well, right now, no. But if I have to walk through that, then I know God will give me the strength. You know, if that, whatever we go through, he gives us the strength. And that's definitely been my experience. If you told me before it was going to happen, I couldn't have coped, and I wouldn't have trusted God enough. But in the experiencing it, it's just been my experience that he's not let me down. But it's a funny testimony, isn't it? Like, when your testimony is that it is in the valley of tears that God sort of is your savior and proves himself trustworthy and faithful and amazing and majestic. Because if you're not a Christian, I mean, a lot of people who, you know, who don't believe in God are like, well, if your God's so good, why do you let that happen to you? And it's kind of hard trying to say, you know, it wasn't God that caused this. You know, I've been fighting for years against the pharmaceuticals who make billions off of doing this to women. So it's not God that caused this, but it's God who's carried me through. And I must admit, at the beginning, you know, with a media background, I kind of was like, hey, God, if I'm your PR person, we need some miracles right now. You know, come on, get me up out of the wheelchair. That'll look really good. And, you know, we'll get some. But it's like, you know, this is the way God is doing it. And that's been a challenge to me because, as you know, you and I have met at various healing meetings. I've prayed for people who've, you know, been healed miraculously, supernaturally, yeah, on the spot. So, and I still know that God does that, that he's, but you can't box God. It's my experience that he doesn't heal everybody the way we want him to, the way we think he should. Sometimes it's a long drawn out.
That's the key, isn't it? The way we think he should.
Exactly. Exactly. All I know is God is working good out of this. And I can, even me and my little, you know, throwing my toys out the pram moods, even I can see, wow, like I don't think as many people would either hear my story or even be interested, or the conversations I've had from my wheelchair, which may be a poetry book, Tales from the Wheelchair, but the conversations I'm able to have that I wouldn't, that nobody would see if I'd just been healed instantly. And so, yeah. Do you know that Bible verse that said his ways are higher than ours? Might be true, John.
Might be. I won't argue with you about it. Have I ever won an argument with you? I don't know.
Well, we could argue about whether you have or haven't, and I would win, and then people would see, no, you haven't.
So you've done all of this stuff, but you've also just written a second book that took you a few years to finish.
145 years to finish or something. See what I mean? No structure. No structure, John.
So
yes.
Tell us about that book. What's it called?
Book.
That book. Yes, that one.
This one. Here's one I prepared earlier. It's called A Mother's Love. And that is, it's a biography of a wee woman who is a hero of mine, called Bridie McGoldrick. Years and years ago, I was interviewing Bridie and her husband Mick for a Christian television station. And so I was making a documentary on ways that God heals. And I had all the miraculous healings and the healings by medicine. And I said, I want to get somebody that God has healed emotionally from something, or, you know, not just a medical condition.
Sure.
So I was told about this couple in Northern Ireland. Went out to interview them, and I didn't know their whole story. And it's the most unprofessional interview I've ever done, because as they sat and shared their story, I sat howling, and I'm sitting with a microphone and a camera filming them, and I'm like, but their story is amazing. The lovely wee couple, Mick's from Northern Ireland, Bridie's from Glasgow. She's lived in Northern Ireland now for about...
Yeah, I knew as soon as you said her name, she was from Glasgow.
Yeah, yeah. So she's from the Gorbals, and she's a right wee from the tenements in Gorbals, and the book is full of actually the early part of her life. So all that, you know, tenement life and living in the Gorbals and playing outside and, you know, sort of post-war Glasgow, and it's fascinating. And it's also a love story, two love stories. Her and Mick, they met when they were children, because she used to go back to the family in Northern Ireland, and she met Mick, and then, like, in her teenage years, they started going out, and he joined the army, and they wrote to each other every single day. Every single day she has a box of all these letters. Anyway, so they got married, and they were only able to have one child, and he was the apple of their eye, and he grew up, and it was kind of history repeated itself. They still went family holidays to Northern Ireland. He met a girl from Northern Ireland. They got married. He moved over there. So Mick and Bridie, both of poor health, they moved over to Northern Ireland too. And they had a great life. And then they became grandparents to Emma, and everything was well. And then their daughter-in-law was actually pregnant again. their son, Michael, had done training to be a teacher. So he just finished university. It was all very amazing. Everything was going well in their life. The second grandbaby was due. They had a celebration at the end of his graduation, and then Mick and Bridie went off to their caravan that they had. And this is this part just always horrifies me. The next morning, they got up and put on, do you remember Teletext? Remember the scrolling news service?
Yeah.
So they put that on, and it said that a 31-year-old taxi driver from Lurgan had been murdered last night. And they didn't instantly think it would be their son, because obviously they weren't thinking they would find out like that. Mm. But they did think it might be somebody that Michael knew, because all the taxi drivers knew each other.
Yeah, they all knew it.
So they put on, and this was at the height of the troubles in Northern Ireland, the height of what was called the Drumcree Standoff. So it was about the Orange wanting to go down the Drumcree, wanting to go down the Gravahi Road, which was a predominantly Republican area. And it was, so it's like, you know, you're not marching here, you're not stopping us, all that. So at the, so they put on BBC News in time to hear a newscaster say a 31-year-old taxi driver from Lurgan, father of one, second child on the way, who just graduated Queen's University, was murdered last night. And that's how they found out their only child was murdered. So it was horrific. And then the police came to the caravan door. And so Michael had been murdered just because he was a Catholic. He actually was murdered as a birthday present for another. So that began a horrific journey for them, obviously. And they both have a Catholic faith, but they would tell you that they didn't really have a faith at that point. You know, they just, you know, they went to mass every week because that's what you did, but they didn't really know Jesus. And in the aftermath of Michael's murder, they both had separate they had a failed, thankfully, suicide attempt, which was quite funny. But you need to buy the book to read about it, John. But that was quite funny, actually, what happened. And so then they realized that they needed to go on living. And it was through reading the Bible for Bridie that God just became real to her. And it was more than just, you know, whatever you're listening to in mass. She realized that God had given up his son. And it was actually, I always remember, it was Ezekiel chapter 41 about the river, you know, up to your ankles, then up to your knees. And she just felt, as she was reading it, that she was having this experience of God that she'd never had before. Simultaneously, Mick is out with the dog, and he has this encounter with the Holy Spirit, just an experience. He wasn't reading a word. He was angry with God and had told God, you know, that, I think he actually said, your son dying on a cross is nothing compared to this, and I'll never smile again, and I'll never be back in chapel. And I'll not, you know, he was so destroyed. And he had this encounter with the Holy Spirit that changed his life. So on the same day, they both are like, oh my goodness, God is real. And so that's quite amazing. And their journey goes on from there. And anyway, on the day of the funeral, and they absolutely doted on Michael. The day of his funeral, there was loads of press attention, and it was a worldwide thing. So Mick actually on the day of the funeral said that they forgave the killers, and they pleaded with both sides of the paramilitaries to, you know, sort of lay down their guns and their hatred. And it was a very, very powerful speech, and it changed the course of so many people's lives and their lives. And God said to them, you know, you can't do anything for Michael now, but I still have children in the world that you can help. And it began a journey of, they set up a charity called United Christian Aid. And they were in Romania, but then Moldova at that point was the poorest country in Europe. And they just went out six times a year, and just so simple. There was nothing complicated about it. They drove about Belfast. They got a wee rickety van. They drove about Belfast. They collected goods, and they took them six times a year over to the people in Moldova. And then they started sort of like sponsoring families. So people in Belfast, I just love that. I love what God does. All the troubles are happening, all the heartache, but still people from Belfast are giving to like Moldova, where they have absolutely nothing. And so, yeah, so that's their story. I'm not going to tell you anything else. Buy the book. It's just, it's a fascinating story.
Where can we buy it?
Go on to my website, www.learnafarrell.com.
Okay. So that's LornaFarrell.com.
Yes. Yes. That's the best place to buy it. Oh. I think you can get it on Amazon, but it just comes direct to me.
But if they buy it from your website, you sign it for them, do you?
If they would like to, yes, you can. When you're ordering, you can put on sign it, and I will. Because I've learned how to spell my name now, John.
Amazon doesn't do that. No.
Exactly.
Lorna, it's been brilliant to chat with you. I always love having chats with you. You're always very up. I know you have hard times, but you're always very uplifting when you meet other people.
Well, likewise.
It's a joy to hang out with you.
Likewise, that big crabbit face of yours is a facade, John, because I know you're just... Oh, it's wonderful to speak with you. It's been way too long.
I know. We need to try and grab a coffee.
Yeah, we do.
A big coffee.
Yes. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, no, it's a joy. And I'm sure I'll keep up with your adventures. And maybe I'll even go and see the play when you finish writing it.
Yes. Next year at the Edinburgh Festival, hold me to it. One woman show. I think I'm going to call it Wheelie Meshed Up.
Go for it.
God bless.
Bless you.
Okay. Bye.
Lots of love. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.